It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
And one of the other delegates asked him, Mr. Glass, won't these provisions that you are asking us to adopt discriminate? And Mr. Glass's answer was, discriminate? What do you think we're here for? We're here to discriminate just as far as the federal Constitution will allow us to do.
Dick Howard, professor of law and public affairs at the University of Virginia, traces the evolution of Virginia's six constitutions in a talk given at the Library of Virginia on September 21, 2012. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn about the new change that allows a claimant for Social Security or SSI disability benefits to either appeal a denied claim or file a new claim, but not both. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 186, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR, 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. The Social Security Administration, or SSA, has changed its policy for filing a new application for disability benefits where a prior denied application is pending at the Appeals Council after it has been turned down in a hearing before an Administrative Law Judge, or ALJ. The new policy applies to all subsequent applications filed on or after July 28, 2011. Now, a claimant who wants to file a new disability claim will have to choose between the administrative appeal to the Appeals Council on the old application or declining to pursue the appeal and filing a new application. The policy change is terrible for claimants whose conditions have worsened. In December 1999, SSA changed its policy to allow the filing and development of a new claim where a prior denied claim had been appealed to the Appeals Council. At that time, there was an enormous backlog at the Appeals Council, and the average time to receive a decision was 2 years, but often took much longer. Claimants whose conditions deteriorated or had a new impairment after the ALJ denial were seriously harmed by the pre-1999 policy. Today, the average time to receive an Appeals Council decision is a little more than a year, but backlogs are increasing earlier in the process. The problem with the new policy is that dropping the appeal of the old denied claim and filing a new claim means giving up the months or years of benefits from the date of the old application to the date of the new application. On the other hand, the majority of appeals are not successful, and waiting to file a new claim once the appeal on the old claim has finally been denied also means giving up months or years of benefits from the date a new application could have been filed until the date the new application actually is filed. There is, however, a limited exception to the new policy. This allows a new claim to be filed and to be given expedited consideration in a critical or dire need situation. The new claim has to involve the same type of benefits, for example, Social Security disability or SSI disability. There also has to be new medical evidence of a new critical or disabling condition with an onset date after the date of the ALJ denial. In this limited situation, the new medical evidence is sent to the Appeals Council electronically. The appeals counsel then will review the new evidence and decide whether a new claim may be filed after all. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. The history of Virginia's Constitution demonstrates the truth of Thomas Jefferson's statement that the earth always belongs to the living generation. Dick Howard, professor of law and public affairs at the University of Virginia, traced the evolution of Virginia's six constitutions in a talk given at the Library of Virginia on September 21, 2012, and the Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show was there. Here are the first half of Professor Howard's remarks.
What I want to do is to give you a very quick sense of the unfolding of Virginia's Constitution, because a fundamental difference between a state constitution and the federal document is that on the federal side, as you know, though it's been amended, we still have the original 1787 document, right? It served us very well. Periodically, states revise their constitutions, typically every generation or so. We've had, as I count them, about six constitutions in Virginia's history. So if you want to start in 1776, imagine chapters in Virginia's constitutional history. When the convention that was ruling, the revolutionary body that was in Williamsburg in 1776, they were the ones who, in May of that year, instructed Virginia's delegates at the Continental Congress to introduce the Resolution for Independence, which finally came about in July. And on the same day that they gave that instruction to their delegates in Philadelphia, they set to work on the first Constitution for Virginia. Today, the Bill of Rights of Virginia is simply Article 1 of the Constitution. It's not broken out as a separate document. I think it's profoundly interesting that the framers of Virginia's first Constitution said that there are two steps we take. First, we proclaim our rights, natural rights, inherent rights, not given to us by government, and then we write the body of the Constitution. It was not an accident that they proceeded that way. Well, the Declaration of Rights has served over the centuries. It has survived very well. That first Constitution, happily, is now history because it was profoundly flawed. It mostly was the product. It protected the interests mostly of the old Tidewater counties and the property owners and the like. It had a very limited suffrage, badly malapportioned. It also reflected a theme of early American state constitutions, which was essentially legislative supremacy, because the lower house of the colonial legislature had been the sort of friends of the people. People in those days didn't trust executives or judges, so they had a weak governor, weak courts, and a powerful legislature. Now, within a few years, that began to be corrected in most other states. Massachusetts, for example, finally by 1780 had a constitution with an authentic separation of powers and checks and balances. But the first Virginia constitution was badly flawed. Jefferson hated it. He spent the next 50 years basically complaining about that first constitution, first on the grounds of limited suffrage. You had to own property to vote. So many men who had fought and risked their lives for their country in the Revolution couldn't vote in Virginia. Secondly, malapportionment, that the old, small Tidewater counties had all the power and the Piedmont and more western counties suffered. He said 17 men in Loudoun had only the same power in the legislature as one man in what was in Warrick County. He didn't like that. He also said, this Constitution is not fundamental law. He said it was drafted and adopted by the same body of men who were making ordinary laws for Virginia. And that won't do, because you've got to have a convention elected for the express purpose of writing a constitution. Then it will be superior to ordinary law, but otherwise it's just basically another statute. And he also objected to the lack of separation of powers. He said, you've given all the power to the legislature, and as he put it, 173 despots would be as bad as one. So there were a lot of things he didn't like about that Constitution, and over the years after 1776, he and others tried to bring about reform. the Virginia court began to treat that first constitution as fundamental law. This is before Marbury versus Madison. This is before John Marshall wrote his famous opinion. The Virginia Supreme Court was beginning to say, well, if the legislature were to enact a law that we thought was unconstitutional, it would be a sober duty, but it would be our duty all the same to declare it unconstitutional. So the principle of judicial review was already taking root in Virginia, even before John Marshall wrote his famous opinion. There is one other interesting addition to that, in effect, to that first constitution, and that was, many you Richmond folks will know all about, the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty. And that statute, written by Thomas Jefferson, was adopted as Virginia law, became effective in January of 1786, and it was important not only for Virginia, but it also was in effect the prelude to what became the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment to the Federal Constitution. Now, that was a statute at the beginning. It was added to and appears today in the Virginia Constitution. So a lot going on in that founding period, some profound fundamental ideas that became part of the mainstream of American constitutional law. But, as I say, it was a controversial document because of the flaws I've just described. And the reformers tried year after year to get a convention called to try to bring about change. Jefferson did not see it happen during his lifetime. But finally, in 1829 and 30, a convention was called 50 years after that first Constitution. It met here in Richmond. It was a convention to rewrite the Constitution. If you ever happen upon the debates, they are in print. 900 finely printed pages. I've read them all. I don't recommend them to you for bedtime reading. You won't make it to the end of the volume. Amazing collection of people who were at that convention. Wonderful oratory and disputation, but finally they didn't do very much. They tinkered a little bit with the 1776 Constitution, but did not really address Jefferson's complaints. The ones I've just mentioned. I think the old forces of conservatism finally carried the day in 1829 and 30. The vote on that Constitution is very revealing. Because it did not achieve reform, the eastern counties, like Sussex and Surrey, voted overwhelmingly for it. The transmontane counties in what today would be West Virginia, overwhelmingly against it. Piedmont a little more divided. If you were to take a map of Virginia and color in the yes and no counties, you'd have a perfect picture. This is 1830, a perfect picture of what became West Virginia. You can see the sectional split taking place as early as that. Well, that was 1829 and 30. 20 years later, they called another convention, which finally in 1850-51 brought about the changes which had not been accomplished in 1829 and 30. And if you're a student of the democratic process, you'll be interested to know that it finally, in 1851, for the first time in Virginia's history, the people were able to elect the governor. 75 years we had, in effect, a parliamentary system where the legislature elected the governor, who was basically a cipher. He was obviously beholden to the legislative body. So 1851, popular governor. Something like a universal white male's franchise. Obviously, slaves were still not part of the citizenship, and women were not yet voting. But they were on the road to reform. They then collided, of course, with the Civil War in the 1860s. After the Civil War, Virginia was military district number one, right, under federal occupation. And part of the requirement which the federal government laid upon the seceding states was twofold. First, they had to ratify the 14th Amendment. Secondly, they had to adopt a new state constitution.
You've been listening to Dick Howard, Professor of Law and Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, speaking about Virginia's six constitutions at a talk given at the Library of Virginia on September 21, 2012. We'll be back in a moment. We continue now with the remarks of Dick Howard, Professor of Law and Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, at a talk given at the Library of Virginia on September 21, 2012, about Virginia's six constitutions.
So in Richmond, there was a state constitutional convention, 1867-68, very unlike those pre-Civil War, the antebellum conventions that I've described. This post-bellum convention, most people who had supported the Confederacy, held any kind of office in the Commonwealth or in the Confederate government, were disenfranchised. They could not be delegates. About a quarter of the delegates were black. Either freedmen or former slaves were members of the convention. Others were what we called at the time radical Republicans and the like. And it was a very progressive body. They actually, among other things, created the first statewide public education system in Virginia. It wasn't very well funded, but at least it was in the Constitution. So that came in, that was the Reconstruction period. And if you know your Southern history, you'll probably be aware that as the Reconstruction period ended, I think the last federal troops left the South in 1876, but after the Hayes-Tilden election, as you passed into the closing decades of the 19th century, the turn of the 20th century, all of the former Confederate states, which had been obliged to write Reconstruction constitutions, then embarked on writing post-Reconstruction constitutions, Virginia included. Two big issues on the table. One was populism. There was enormous rage among Southern states against railroads and corporations and the like. So that's when they created the State Corporation Commission as a, in effect, a fourth branch of government. There was an article on the Corporation Commission making it a very powerful independent body in Virginia alongside the courts, the legislature, and the executive. The other issue that was on the table was race. Black votes had mattered in Virginia politics in the late 19th century. Both parties would tend to need black voters to achieve political office, and the so-called Bourbon Democrats, the conservative Democrats who were in the ascendancy, set out to use the new Constitution to do something about the black vote. So disenfranchisement was very much part of what that convention was about. During the debates, I think you'd be stunned by the candor of the delegates on the floor of this convention. It's 1901-1902. Carter Glass, later senator, later architect of the Federal Reserve System, was the sort of floor manager of the electoral, the voting sections of the proposed Constitution. And one of the other delegates asked him, Mr. Glass, won't these provisions that you are asking us to adopt discriminate? And Mr. Glass's answer was, discriminate? What do you think we're here for? We're here to discriminate just as far as the federal Constitution will allow us to do. And this is the period, this is the era of Plessy versus Ferguson. It was a period during which, frankly, Northerners who at one time after the Civil War were concerned about Reconstruction, they had moved on to the gilded age of capitalism and frankly weren't very much worrying about what was happening in the South. So Glass and his fellow delegates knew they could really push the boundaries pretty far in terms of getting blacks out of Virginia politics. So they adopted two things in particular. One was the poll tax, the famous poll tax. $1.50 a year doesn't sound like a whole lot of money, but to a working person in 1902, that was a lot of money, and it was cumulative. Didn't pay last year's, you had to pay 2 years in a row, and it did add it up. And the other provision was registration. You could be asked as a prospective voter to go to the registrar, and he would hand you the Virginia Constitution, and just pick a section at random, and ask you to explain it. There's sections in the Virginia Constitution I can't explain. So you go into the registrar, and you happen to be of the wrong color, right? And you know that no matter what kind of answer you give, he's not going to be satisfied. So you're going to be denied registration. So you know that, so you're not going to take off the day and lose a day's pay to go down to go through this charade. So the result was the shrinking overnight of the black vote in Virginia. The disenfranchisement was so effective in Virginia, not only black voters, but poor whites. It hit them hard as well. So it was 1928, before as many people voted in a general election in Virginia as had voted in 1898. And during that 30-year period, Virginia's population had doubled, and women got the vote, so the potential electorate quadrupled. but still you can see the absolute number of voters. Now, when that Constitution was proposed to the people, the delegates were under a moral obligation to have it voted on, referendum. They pledged that. But they looked at this document they had written, and they could well imagine, well, will people who are about to be disenfranchised by this proposed Constitution vote yes? Maybe not. So they simply promulgated it. They simply said to the people of Virginia, here is your new Constitution. Well, you know, some people said, now, wait a minute. You can't just do that. You know, people get to vote on it. There was a case in the Supreme Court in 1904, Taylor versus Commonwealth, in which Mr. Taylor, having been convicted under a statute adopted after the promulgation of the 1902 Constitution, said, this statute is not valid because it's based on a Constitution which is not properly adopted. And the Supreme Court of Virginia kind of shuffled their feet a little bit, and they were a little bit embarrassed, and they said, well, you know, this is a tough question, but we're, looks like the governor and the legislature and the judges, everybody took their oath of office under the 1902 Constitution, it must be valid. So they rejected Taylor's complaint. So that Constitution came into place, and you who are buffs of Virginia history, some of you will remember the Byrd Machine. If you wonder how the Byrd Machine had such long staying power, think about the 1902 Constitution. Restricted, very restricted franchise, so that only a handful of voters to worry about, and you'd get the different courthouses around the state to take care of things at the local level. That went on for decades. Harry Byrd, as governor in 1928, gave us the short ballot. Governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, no others on the state ballot. Things changed then in the 1960s. Some of you will remember the federal initiatives of the 1960s. The Supreme Court declared one person, one vote. So the legislature as well as Congress had to be reapportioned based on population. You couldn't malapportion. Secondly, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, surely the most important single civil rights measure since Reconstruction. And under that statute, which covered Virginia, you could not change voting laws without permission of the Attorney General's office in Washington or the District Court in D.C. Poll tax was abolished. Supreme Court decision held that that was unconstitutional. So it was a total and radical reconstruction of the constitutional scene. And in the 60s, Virginia was on its way to becoming, after all those decades of conservative democratic rule, a two-party state. Linwood Holton, first Republican governor of Virginia since Reconstruction. A lot of things were happening, and it was precisely at that point that Mills Godwin appointed the Commission on Constitutional Revision. Commission went to work, reported to the legislature. They did some further revisions, and it went to a referendum. I was asked by Linwood Holton to run the referendum campaign. Well, I know anything about politics. I'd never run for office. But I said, sure, I can. I mean, again, I was a law professor. I can do that, too. If I can write you a constitution, I can run you a referendum campaign. So I took leave of absence, went around the state, made speeches. I got to know Virginia in a way that I never would have. I couldn't have dreamed of the diversity and variety of this commonwealth. Amazing campaign. We had our banners, our lapel pins and all that just had the logo, yes, yes. So we won the referendum, 72% of the vote. I mean, that's a landslide in politics. We carried all 10 congressional districts. We carried places. Fairfax County voted like 85%. So like a Bulgarian plebiscite, doesn't it? I mean, you know, but we won big time. Some important changes took place. Education is now in the Bill of Rights. We reformed the education article. We rewrote the judicial article, the first environmental quality provision, and so forth. If nothing else, we made it short and simple and readable. We took out about half of that stuff that was in the old Constitution, rearranged the rest of it. You can now find your way around in the Virginia Constitution.
You've been listening to Dick Howard, Professor of Law and Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, speaking about Virginia's six constitutions at a talk given at the Library of Virginia on September 21, 2012. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. They're gonna let 'em oppress 'em. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral four, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. How are judges chosen in Virginia? When the Virginia State Senate has a tie vote, when can the Lieutenant Governor break it and when not? Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when Senior Justice of the Supreme Court of Virginia, Elizabeth Lacy, and Private Attorney Lane Needler, a former Chief Deputy Attorney General of Virginia, answer these important constitutional questions. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.